It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, Congress passed the largest housing affordability bill in decades with substantial bipartisan support.
The bill has numerous provisions, including banning corporate investors from buying hundreds of homes to rent, encouraging more home construction, and loosening regulations on manufactured homes.
But President Donald Trump canceled the signing ceremony yesterday and posted on Truth Social he is tying the bill's future to a strict voter ID and proof of citizenship bill, the Save America Act.
While the landmark housing bill awaits Trump's signature, we're taking a look at what it could mean here in Wisconsin.
Paul Aylesworth is Director of Affordable and Sustainable Housing Development in the Department of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison. Paul, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, looking at the politics of this for a sec, it's tangled. I think it's fair to say, if you ask, will this thing come into law? The answer is probably, question mark. That said, if it does come into law, sponsors, supporters here in our congressional delegation from both parties say it's a big deal. Is it a big deal if it comes into law?
I think absolutely it's a big deal. I mean, this is a bill that's trying to kind of crack the big nut that is increasing housing supply in our state, which, you know, most folks agree is the main contributor to the high housing costs. Studies estimate that the state needs to build between 140,000 and 227,000 homes in the next few years to keep up with demand. And, you know, while this bill is sort of, I'd say, offers a ton of incremental, it's a ton of incremental changes. They're important changes. You know, stimulating housing demand is a tricky thing because it often takes a lot of small fixes and often takes a lot of time. And this bill certainly is reflective of that. It is voluminous. I struggle to even get to, we won't be able to talk about everything
every
in this bill.
Every single point, right. Well, let's start digging into some details here. One that gets a lot of attention, and there's some argument over how much impact it'd have, is this idea of corporate ownership of single-family homes, the idea that private equity companies are buying a bunch of single-family homes, turning them into rentals. This puts limits, if I'm a corporation, on how many houses I can buy here. Is this something that ultimately makes a difference in housing cost or that key part of it, supply?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel less convinced about this one, to be totally honest with you. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to bed every night worried about the fate of private equity. However, you know, if you look at the numbers, investors really only make up 3% of the ownership of single-family homes across the country. I don't know if we're barking up exactly the right tree on this one. Plus, single-family rentals can offer a meaningful opportunity for folks who otherwise don't have the capital, don't have significant barriers to buying a home, for them to be able to get into a neighborhood, a home that has the amenity structure, maybe good schools, access to transit, things they might like. So I think we need to find ways to, in some ways, to even possibly support single-family rentals.
Now, another part of this is increasing the amount that capital banks can invest in low-income housing. And you've worked as an affordable housing developer in the past, I understand. What kind of impact could this have on Wisconsin's supply of affordable housing?
Yeah, this one I think could be significant. So basically, this piece of the legislation allows banks that can currently only invest 15% of their capital in what's called public welfare investments, which includes affordable housing, and takes that amount up to 20%. And that can free up really across the country billions of dollars to invest into projects funded by some of the main tools that tend to finance affordable housing, like low-income housing tax credits, the types of credits that in Wisconsin WEDA is responsible for organizing, administrating, and distributing. In a way, this is a nice piece of coordination at a federal level. Last year, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act significantly increased the amount of low-income housing tax credits that are available to developers to build affordable housing. That increase in credit available had an impact in the market. It seemed as though credits were somewhat devalued because of the increase in credit tax credits available. This will increase the amount of capital into that system, hopefully rebalancing some of those markets, enabling us to stretch those credit dollars farther, build more housing.
Now, affordable housing.
Affordable housing, that means, specifically.
That means different things to different people, though. People at very low income levels who could otherwise not afford houses, even if the prices were fairly low, that might mean them. But workers who have fine jobs in a community, but the housing prices are so high, when we're talking about affordable housing, are we talking about that kind of workforce housing as well, or is that another category?
So we're absolutely talking about workforce housing here. So, you know, developments financed by the low-income housing tax credit, they're targeted, especially in areas with increasing housing costs. They house a lot of your sort of your teachers, your workers, your folks who are filling important civic roles in communities. They're absolutely workforce housing. I will say, though, and I did development like this for quite a while. Some of these tools, including the ones I'm talking about, struggle to hit the very lowest income brackets. Folks earning at what we call 30% of the area median income or less. They are often the hardest folks to serve and house. And in Wisconsin, we have a significant issue, as basically every state in the country does, in serving those folks. And I'm talking about people in Wisconsin averaging households at like $31,000 a year earning and below. But, you know, those are like home health aides, nursing assistants. These are working people, sometimes seniors, sometimes folks with disabilities. You know, 72% of those households are extremely cost burdened, meaning they're spending over 30, sometimes over 50% of their income on rent. You know, I do absolutely question whether this bill and these changes will provide meaningful outcomes for those folks. I definitely question whether this bill will provide meaningful changes for these sort of housing insecure folks in the short term.
We're talking about the housing affordability bill that passed Congress this week, awaiting action from the president. Paul Aylesworth is with us from UW-Madison, director of affordable and sustainable housing development there. Paul, a couple of weeks back, I talked to a local leader in northwestern Wisconsin who's looking at manufactured homes as part of their solution, saying, hey, we need to give them another look here in Wisconsin. There is some action on that. This gets a little funky. Changing regulations on the chassis of these things, saying, hey, these don't have to be mobile homes that you can move from one place to another. Talk us through that. And is this something that could meet maybe some of those needs of that lower income spectrum that you were talking about?
Yeah, I think it could. I mean, it's also an incremental change. I've seen estimates saying that on a particular build, that the chassis might cost something like $5,000 to $10,000. So significant. And it's true. And I think it's meaningful and logical. It's a meaningful and logical thing to change. A lot of times, manufactured homes are delivered to where they are and put on a foundation and not moved. So why do you need a chassis? So I think that is meaningful. There's also some work in this legislation to aid in sort of financing and mortgage availability for manufactured housing. So yeah, I think that there's a step in the right directions there.
As you mentioned at the outset, we can't get to every detail here. What else stands out to you in this legislation that you see as a potential difference maker?
Yeah, I think, and I'm when I was, you know, preparing to be on and speak with you guys, I was thinking specifically about Wisconsin and specifically about rural communities, honestly. I think, you know, I did most of my housing development in urban settings. A lot of housing programs work better in urban areas for a lot of different reasons. But there are some things that can help rural places, too. So there's a program called Section 515 that's financed affordable housing, subsidized affordable housing in rural communities for a long time. It's a sort of combination of mortgage assistance to a developer and rental assistance to tenants. A lot of those mortgages are coming due, ending. This program decouples the mortgage, the rental assistance from the mortgage, allowing those tenants to continue with affordable rents. So I think that could be meaningful in rural areas. Another thing that's been interesting about this bill is that, you know, I have a hard time not critiquing it because it's cost neutral, right? This whole thing is designed not to increase any costs. There's not new spending here. So I could literally talk you down any of these programs and probably say, well, if there was more money in this, it would be better. However, there's been some meaningful changes in here, I think, to two federal block grant programs, home and community development block grants. And specifically community development block grants, the change to them, that it's and for a bit of context, these are federal dollars that are available to municipalities and counties across the country and in Wisconsin to traditionally do a bunch of community development activities, whether it's sort of public infrastructure projects, economic development, and also, to this point, aid in some sort of repairs of existing housing type of work. This bill allows those funds, which are available to communities across the state, to use that for new construction of housing. So it's not increasing the overall pie to do that, to do kind of all of that stuff. Probably do need more money, but it is meaningfully allowing and giving the flexibility to use those funds to leverage to create more affordable housing in some of these places. So I think some meaningful sort of nips and tucks to make things more effective, make things more flexible, and over time and together probably have a big impact.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
That's Paul Aylesworth, Director of Affordable and Sustainable Housing Development in the Department of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison. We've been talking about this bipartisan housing bill passed by Congress, awaiting action by the White House now. In the meantime, love to hear what your community needs, maybe your own family needs, when it comes to housing availability and affordability in your neck of the woods. Send us an email. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, Congress debates the year-round sales of a fuel blended with 15% corn-based ethanol. More demand for corn, but are there trade-offs?
Are the actual environmental benefits from that reduced carbon footprint in fuel actually offsetting greenhouse gas emissions that are emitted from agricultural production directly?
A look at the E15 debate, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The White House asked Congress yesterday to pass a law that would allow year-round sales of gasoline that is blended with 15% ethanol. Legislation allowing year-round sales of E15 narrowly passed the House last month. The proposal is now being considered by the Senate.
Members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation on both sides of the aisle have come out in support of permanent year-round sales, including Republican Representative Derek Van Orden and Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Supporters say it would lower the price at the pump and help Wisconsin farmers.
A lower 10% ethanol blend is sold all year, but the E15 blend, also known as unleaded 88, is usually banned from sale from June to September due to pollution concerns. But the Environmental Protection Agency, under the second Trump administration, has issued a waiver allowing it to be sold through the summer.
President Trump spoke about the change during a rally in Chippewa Falls earlier this month.
We eliminated all unnecessary restrictions on sales of E15, and I've made it clear that we're going to go E15 all year round, and I think it's something that you want, right? Do you like that? Are you happy with that?
Corn and biofuel advocates argue that the fuel burns cleaner than other fuel types and that year-round E15 could serve as a lifeline for corn farmers in Wisconsin and beyond.
But critics like Clean Wisconsin say year-round E15 would lead to increased land contamination through the use of nitrate fertilizers to grow the corn. They also argue it would worsen ozone pollution in the summer and could lead to higher rates of asthma and respiratory infections.
For a closer look at this issue, we have Jeff Hadachek, an assistant professor and extension specialist in agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison, Jeff, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks, Kate.
And Scott Irwin is a professor and agricultural economist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and a biofuel policy researcher. Scott, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Scott, starting with you, the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association and other groups, they have promoted E15 as a benefit for farmers and for people at the pump. What impact would permanent year-round sale of E15 fuel have on farmers who grow corn for ethanol production?
Well, the big benefit for farmers is expanding demand. Gasoline in the United States currently has almost every gallon 10% ethanol by volume in it. And if we went to 15% ethanol, which is what E15 represents, that would be a 50% increase in the demand for corn used to make ethanol. So that's the potential that's out there for farmers. It's a lot more complicated whether that would end up saving money for drivers.
Can you put that demand increase in perspective? How big of an increase is that?
50% would be jumping probably at least 2 to 2.5 billion bushels of increased corn demand. So that would be, a significant chunk of what the United States produces in corn. You know, our crop is someplace around 16 billion bushels. So you can divide the two and get a pretty good idea that it would be very significant.
Jeff, Wisconsin being a major corn-growing state, the State Agriculture Department says much of our state's corn is used for ethanol production for fuel. Would year-round sales alter the amount of corn in production here? Would farmers here grow more of it?
Yeah, likely. And as Scott pointed out, the raising of corn prices means that corn becomes more favorable from a market perspective relative to other crops. And even it may mean that, you know, previously uncultivated land may come into production.
And Wisconsin lawmakers have said drivers at the pump would pay less with this change for year-round E15. What impact could this year-round change have on fuel prices? Is there any way to know that, Scott?
Well, it is an area of significant debate, and there's strong views. So I want to state that up front. And my perspective is that there's potential for E15 to save drivers money, particularly with some of the incentives available through the Renewable Fuel Standard program. But on the other side, even if this RVP waiver is passed, there are some significant hurdles to increasing the adoption of E15 across the country. And those hurdles, other hurdles, involve costs. And so it's debatable whether in the end it would save drivers a lot of money once we absorbed all those costs. So that's the point of debate.
Where are these costs coming from? Would it be from, you know, the farm itself? Would it be costs for inputs? Would it be at refineries?
Well, it probably wouldn't be at the farm level because we have the ability to produce the additional corn, I believe, without much increase in the cost of or price of corn and inputs. It would probably raise the price of corn some, but that's not the really significant issue. If we take a look at the fuel supply chain, all the way from divided into three parts, the upstream refining level, the midstream logistical and pipeline level, and at the downstream retail gasoline station level. There are significant costs to the transition to E15 at each of those points in the supply chain.
Jeff, advocates for E15 biofuel, they have argued that this fuel reduces harmful emissions, but we hear from environmental groups like Clean Wisconsin who've come out against allowing E15 fuel to be used year-round. What are some of these environmental concerns around going to E15 biofuel year-round?
It's a good question, and it's somewhat of a double-edged sword, because as you mentioned, you know, there are direct environmental potential benefits from the reduced reliance on fossil fuels, right? So if we're making more of our fuels that we drive in our vehicles from corn ethanol, then that's less fossil fuels that we are extracting and emitting into the atmosphere. The other side, though, is that some of these indirect channels, as you maybe mentioned that Clean Wisconsin has come out with, is that if we're cultivating more corn acres in Wisconsin and in the U.S. generally, that means that we are also increasing the inputs that are required for corn grain. Corn is typically more input intensive, particularly for nitrogen fertilizers, than other crops like soybeans or maybe wheat is. And so we're adding more nitrogen into the environment, which particularly for our here locally in Wisconsin in the Central Sands, you know, we have very high nitrate levels in domestic private wells, which impose costs on those rural households who are exposed to those higher levels, and also potential risks. We are also, if that nitrogen is not absorbed by the crop, we're susceptible to runoff that ends up in our surface water bodies and ends up eventually in the Gulf, creating hypoxic zones. So, there are environmental considerations, downsides as well with it. And, on the other side of this too, cultivating more land also emits carbon itself into the atmosphere. And so even though we may be reducing a carbon footprint from the pure fuel perspective, we also have to consider the land impacts of just purely just cultivating more land. And I think that is somewhat of an issue of debate as well, as are the actual environmental benefits from that reduced carbon footprint in fuel actually offsetting the cost, whether it be for nitrogen, for additional water use, for the greenhouse gas emissions that are emitted from agricultural production directly.
And with this additional cultivation, one thing you didn't mention, but I want to bring up, are there risks with monocropping, with farmers not rotating their crops as often, perhaps, and just planting corn? Is that an issue?
Sure. And it all contributes to the that same kind of issue. So if we are monocropping for corn, one of the things that is beneficial in a crop rotation is that the soybeans themselves, being legumes, will produce nitrogen and leave nitrogen in the soil, meaning that there is some residual nitrogen left over for the corn the following year. If we're purely monocropping corn, for example, that means that we're putting in we're having to put in additional synthetic nitrogen to that soil, which is then going to be either left on the surface and maybe susceptible to runoff. All that being said, though, farmers can take a number of practices and probably have better idea today than they did 20 years ago when the renewable fuel standard was first implemented, on practices that can prevent these things from happening in the first place. And we also have additional incentives from a market perspective to help incentivize sustainable practices, conservation practices that keep nitrogen in the soil, that absorb residual nitrogen. It's a double-edged sword. It's a complex issue, as Scott mentioned. There are certainly downsides, but I think there are ways as well that we can incentivize optimal management of it.
We're talking about what legalizing the year-round sale of E15 biofuel could mean for Wisconsin farmers. We have Scott Irwin there, professor and agricultural economist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And Jeff Hatichek is with us as well, an assistant professor and extension specialist in agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison. Scott, I understand a major point of contention with getting enough support for national E15 legislation is around exemptions for small refineries. Why is this such a critical aspect and an attention point on this issue?
Well, it's definitely contentious. It has to do with when the U.S. renewable fuels standards, or mandates as they're commonly called, were set up. There was a provision where small refineries could be exempted out of the program. Mm-hmm. That sounds so simple. But under the first Trump administration, that was the small refinery exemption or SRE program was basically used as a backdoor mechanism for cutting the size of the mandates. And so that's the important context. And so, you know, that has become a very contentious issue between the crude oil refining sector and the agricultural biofuels sector, that action. And so the E15 bill that was passed by the House ties the passage of the RVP waiver to allow year-round sales of E15 across the United States with some changes in the SRE program, some of them helpful to agricultural and biofuels interests, some of them not helpful. And it's the not helpful part that I think has been surprising to people and has caused within agriculture a real debate about whether on net is this overall good for corn and soybean farmers in the Midwest.
And then too, you know, lawmakers on Capitol Hill have to figure out how they fall on the issue. And I'm wondering, do you see an appetite in Congress for this ethanol policy change and this give and take around small refineries and blending laws?
Well, it did pass the U.S. House. Mm-hmm. It appears, from what I've been able to gather, that it's got a rough future getting passed in the U.S. Senate. I think that the likelihood is probably pretty low at this point that it's going to pass in the Senate because of the nature of a few senators, particularly with those with have strong refining interest in their states, have more power to block it than they did in the House.
Jeff, I understand that this a key piece of this conversation, as we've been talking about, our country's renewable fuel standards, how they impact demand for crops like corn, and we've talked a bit about soybeans. How have these standards impacted our agricultural sector?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think we can look retrospectively at the renewable fuel standard that was passed almost 20 years ago as a case study about for what we might expect, expanding that to be. So some research, not done by me, but done by some colleagues and folks that I know, said over the course of, 10 years after the renewable fuel standard, it raised corn prices by 30%. That led then to 9% more cultivated area and about 9% more corn acres on average. That was directly from this increased demand that we kind of started talking about in this conversation. And that meant that we had about 5% on average more nitrogen fertilizers applied as a result of the renewable fuel standard. And then all of those things then led to some of those environmental externalities, increased environmental externalities that I kind of discussed, whether that's nitrogen in our groundwater, in our surface water, GHG emissions from cultivation and land in general. Now, like I mentioned, though, maybe it's we wouldn't expect necessarily the same impacts to happen today because we have alternative incentives for limiting those impacts. It's maybe even questionable on the margin how much corn prices would change today relative to what they changed from the initial passage of the renewable fuel standard. So a ton of caveats there, but those are some, we can look retrospectively about what some of those impacts have been for relying on some of our fuel supply from corn ethanol.
Amid these caveats, Scott, what are you watching for, you know, whether it's on Capitol Hill or in farm communities as this E15 is being debated?
Well, it has a lot of headline value in the farm country. It's gathered a lot of support, and it's become somewhat of an emotional issue within farm country, particularly as we're looking at squeeze margins and relatively low grain prices. And so this is viewed as, you know, one way out of that squeeze is to increase demand through corn ethanol. So I'm just watching to see how the legislative tea leaves work their way out. Again, my expectation is probably at least this round going to be disappointed that it doesn't get passed.
Well, Scott and Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Scott Irwin is a professor and agricultural economist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And Jeff Hadachek is an assistant professor and extension specialist in agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison. We've been looking at perspectives on year-round E15 production and the potential impact of expanding the sale for both corn growers and consumers in Wisconsin if the legislation is passed by Congress.
Coming up, the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend creates a Wisconsin Cartoonist Laureate program recognizing the state's long history in American comics.
To give a place for this art form in the state, I think it's a fantastic idea, and I'm very happy they chose me for it.
Meet the public ambassador for cartoon art. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to Poets Laureate, who are ambassadors for poetry in communities all over the state.
Now, a Wisconsin Art Museum has launched a program to name a Wisconsin Cartoonist Laureate. The Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend is honoring Milwaukee cartoonist Paul Noth as its first ambassador for the art form.
The Cartoonist Laureate program is also recognizing Wisconsin's important role in the history of American comics. Here's a brief tour.
In 1917, Sidney Smith of Lake Geneva launched The Gumps.
Frank O. King of Toma followed with Gasoline Alley in 1921.
Dennis Kitchen founded Kitchen Sink Press in 1970, a pioneering publisher of underground comics.
Fast forward decades later, and Wisconsin remains fertile ground for comic artists. Paul Noth has published over 400 cartoons in The New Yorker. He was the 2025 winner of the Thurber Prize for American Humor in Cartoon Art. In addition to his comics, he's the author of a middle grade graphic novel trilogy. His first published collection of cartoons comes out in the fall. It's called I'm Going to Eat You and Other Awkward Truths, a cartoonist romp through the lunacy of our times. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
What does the title of Cartoonist Laureate mean to you?
You know, I'm not sure. It's a great honor. I'm very happy that they have a Cartoonist Laureate, and I'm honored and humbled that they chose me to be the inaugural one. And it's the only other state that has a Cartoonist Laureate is Vermont, which they do through the Center for Cartoon Studies, which is a great program that I've always admired. And the idea that the Museum of Wisconsin Art will be doing a similar thing here to, give a place for this art form in the state is, I think it's a fantastic idea. And I'm very happy they chose me for it.
What would you like to accomplish in these 3 years that you'll have this title?
Well, I think that it is to help promote and develop the art form in the state. That's the sort of the guideline. I think the main thing I want to do is sort of figure out how this position is going to do it, you know, to make this a thing and, you know, that people understand what it is and that it's a resource for young up and coming cartoonists in the state, and also a way to honor the history of cartooning in the state, which is very impressive. So I hope to figure out what the position is as I go through it.
What is some of that history of cartooning in Wisconsin? Are there some milestones we should know about?
Well, definitely. Going all the way back, it has a great, just like Wisconsin's political history is very important to the nation, its early history of political cartooning is also very important. And then in the sort of golden age of strip cartoons, you know, some of the greatest ones were from out of Wisconsin and by Wisconsin artists, like Frank King's Gasoline Alley, which was a real milestone throughout all those years. And then in sort of like the independent era and the underground era, Wisconsin was maybe the most important state because Kitchen Sink Press was out of Wisconsin, which was run by Dennis Kitchen. And sort of all of those great underground artists published through Kitchen Sink Press, including Dennis himself. And then like just throughout the years, like just, you know, I'm mainly known as a New Yorker cartoonist. And there are just a lot of other New Yorker cartoonists are from Wisconsin, including P.S. Muller, who's been doing great cartoons, I think, since the early days of The Onion. You know, it's just a great tradition. It's just, you know, I could go on and on. And then contemporary people like Linda Barry, Craig Thompson. It's a big, rich tradition that we have here. And I think it's fantastic that the museum has chosen to honor it this way.
You feel like you're in good company.
Absolutely.
I wonder, when you were growing up, did you race on Sundays to find the Sunday funnies?
Oh, absolutely. And literally every day. And growing up in Milwaukee, there was a great comics section in the Milwaukee Journal and then the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel growing up. It was called The Green Sheet. And it was, you know, it was literally printed on green paper. And that was, you know, my favorite part of the newspaper, my favorite part of the day. And I couldn't get enough cartoons and I read them constantly.
Where did your love of cartoons come from?
It's hard to say. It goes back from before I could even remember. They were just sort of part of my consciousness from the time I was a little kid. And I was always drawing them, too. Speaking of that newspaper, my father worked there. He was the movie critic and the feature editor at the Journal. Mm-hmm. And so he would bring home, you know, cartoon books that came across the feature desk for me, too. And I never really expected to do it for a living, even though I loved it so much. I mean, he kind of warned me. He was like, this industry's in trouble. You don't want to go into the newspaper business, you know. And so I didn't think print journalism would ever be a thing for me. But that just happened to be the way that it worked out.
What did your first cartoons look like?
They looked like a little kid's cartoons.
Okay.
I think it was more like of just an interest than like an innate talent. You know, I was trying to draw like my favorite cartoons. I would be trying to draw Snoopy and Charlie Brown and stuff like that. And then now and then I would have my own little characters that would crop up. And those actually don't look that different from some of the recurring characters I have now. Funny little guys and dogs, a lot of dogs and cats too.
What were the curiosities of those characters? Were they shy? Were they troublemakers? What were they like?
Sometimes they were troublemakers. I always really liked sort of regular looking people in absurd situations. And I think maybe I got that from the Peanuts strip too, a little bit. Like, I like realistic characters. Mm-hmm. The situations can be very absurd, but I want the characters in it, whether they're human or not, to be relatable.
You have had published hundreds of cartoons in The New Yorker, and The New Yorker, and we rushed to them in our house. I mean, they're iconic, the single panel caption style. Is that your preferred format?
It is now. I mean, I wasn't, I kind of got into it. I never thought I could get into The New Yorker because I just grew up with such a knowledge of it and its history. And I knew it was the hardest place to ever possibly get into. So I never even tried. I didn't try until I met a New Yorker cartoonist. I was living in New York and I brought some of my other writing to a monthly show called The Rejection Show in New York because I hadn't been able to sell any of my writing at all. And so I, you know, this was a place where a live show where people bring in their best rejected material. And that's where I met a cartoonist named Matt Diffie, who's a great New Yorker cartoonist and children's author. And I showed him some of my work and he really encouraged me to submit to The New Yorker. And when you do that, they strongly recommend you do 10 cartoons a week. And then a very good week, you sell one. So it's a lot of rejection. But the discipline of doing that and to going into the single panel format, I really took to it right away. And it helped me focus. It limited my options. And for me, that is a great way to work. And so I've been doing it 21 years since then.
When you got your first one accepted, what was that like? What was that moment like?
I absolutely couldn't believe it. It was because it was from my first batch, you know, and it was some people submit for, you know, years, like literally like decades before they sell to the New Yorker. And I was just hoping that they would like them enough to invite me to come to the meetings. Like in those days, there were look meetings where all the cartoonists would get together and show the editor, the cartoon editor, their work. And then they'd all go to lunch and I'd get to go there. And I maybe, you know, I could meet George Booth or Sam Gross or Gayan Wilson, any of these great sort of heroes of mine. And so that was the most I was kind of hoping for. And then to hear I sold for my first batch just kind of blew my mind.
We're talking with cartoonist Paul Noth. Through a program at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend, he has been named a cartoonist laureate from Wisconsin. Many of your popular cartoons, they have a political bent. Some of them speak directly to Wisconsin issues like data centers, like gerrymandering. Has living in our politically active state, our battleground state in national politics, influenced your work?
Yeah, it probably has. I never thought I would do political work, and it doesn't seem like the work that I most want to do or that I most connect with. But going back to that first batch of cartoons I submitted to the New Yorker, I only had, of the 10 I submitted, only one was political, and that was the one that sold. And then the next week I submitted 10 more and only one was political, and that was the one that sold. And so despite my best efforts, I became a political cartoonist, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not that I'm not interested in politics. It's just that I can find it oppressive, you know, and just you almost want to turn it off sometimes because it can be a bummer. But I think it's a good percentage of the cartoons I do end up being political. And those are often the ones people respond to the most.
And in politics, it can be ugly. What do you see as the role of humor in politics?
I'm not sure. I don't like it to be in the ugly part of it, though. You know, I'm sure some of my cartoons can get a little bit rough, you know, especially if I'm feeling passionate about something. But I don't like them to lower the bar in terms of the discourse too much.
But how do you know?
I really don't. No. You know, I feel like I just go with the funniest idea and then see if the editors like it for the most part. If something's over the line, I think like my editors would probably pull me back, you know, and say, this isn't for us. But I like to give the other side the benefit of the doubt, you know, depending on which side of the issue I'm on. During the Obama presidency, I published lots of political cartoons, you know, and during the Bush and Trump years, the same thing. I just feel like it's my job to go with the funniest idea I have and an idea that is not the same thing everybody else is doing. I think that's the risk of political cartoons or topical cartoons in general, is you start doing the same stuff that's everywhere else, you know? And so if I have an original take on something, if I have a fresh perspective on something, I think that's worth doing.
Paul, I think editorial cartoonists, they could be a barometer for gauging the health of a democracy. Have you ever dealt with censorship or felt like your work was not your work was being censored, and how did you approach that?
With the New Yorker, the best I can hope for is that they only reject 9 of every 10 cartoons, you know? And so it would be hard to claim that it's censorship because of that. It's just, they're just being very exclusive about stuff. And also, it's a great privilege to get to work for them because they're not really, even in a political climate where there's a lot of pressure for censorship, they're not knuckling under at all about anything. Now, they have their standards that aren't always the same as my standards. You know, like I might be willing to make a joke that they wouldn't be willing to make, but I think that's a little bit different than censorship, you know? And so I'm very lucky to have an outlet like The New Yorker or I've published other places like The Nation or Politico or The Wall Street Journal. And I usually feel like so far, it's not a question of censorship when my work is rejected.
Yeah.
But it certainly happened to my friends. I've seen it happen to a lot of people. And so the freedom for being able to do political satire, is a barometer for freedom and democracy in our country. You know, and I have friends who work for late night comedy shows that are going off the air because of this climate.
Circling back to Wisconsin here, as part of your role as cartoonist laureate, you'll be teaching cartooning workshops for kids this summer. What kind of advice do you give to young cartoonists?
Well, one of my favorite exercises to do with them is we do a workshop where we come up with our own cartoons, and it's a lot of fun to do that with a group of kids. And I do this project with them that I call the Bad Idea Notebook Project. And that's based on the way I work. We have a notebook just says bad ideas on the front, and that lets you get, you know, it frees you up. You're not trying to be good. You know, you're just trying to write down and draw as many bad ideas as you can, which is literally the actual way I work. I just keep my pen or pencil going, write down thoughts, doodle pictures, and not worry about whether they're any good or not. And somehow through doing that, you plant enough seeds that something grows that you actually like.
So go for volume. Just keep those ideas
exactly flowing.
Exactly.
Go for volume and most of all, be free and don't, you know, get over the inner censor. Stop shutting yourself down before you've had the idea.
I wonder where you draw inspiration from, or as you go about your day, what you might find a moment where you say, oh, yeah, I got to put that thought down, or I'm going to doodle that. Like, you know, what stands out to you?
You know, it's funny. It's like it can come from anywhere.
Okay.
You know, like it can come from conversation. It can come from a book I'm reading. I like to, in the morning, get up and just write down a couple of ideas, you know, just make sure I, and that is not because they're good ideas, but it's just to remind myself what I do and to turn my cartoon brain on. And then, like, you know, the antenna will be up and I will pick up on things in conversations, or like little visual ideas will come to me and I'll be like, maybe that's something, you know, that's worth writing down. Because the thing about humor is that it's surprising when it works.
Yeah.
You know, so I have to sort of be open to it from anywhere.
Writer's block is a thing. Do you ever go through something like that as a cartoonist?
Yes. I think it's just because I've been doing it so long. Like, I've been doing it 21 years. And so sometimes I'll get up and I'll be like, I don't even know what a cartoon is anymore. You know, like they all, it's all so familiar to me. And the only way through that is to just do it anyway, you know, write down a bunch of ideas and be like, you know, the bad idea notebook thing again, you know, like, it's like, I know these aren't good, but if I play with them, if I let myself get a little bored, you know, it's just that I sometimes feel bored with it. But if it's boring enough, like, that part of my brain will start entertaining me, you know, or that's what I hope anyway.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
That is Milwaukee cartoonist Paul Noth. Over the years, he's created hundreds of cartoons for The New Yorker and was recently named Cartoonist Laureate for Wisconsin through a program created by the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. And for disclosure, the Museum of Wisconsin Art is a business sponsor of WPR.
It's wedding season, and some people do their weddings a bit differently. WKOW-TV in Madison shared the story of a couple that renewed their vows on a water slide in Wisconsin Dells, part of an effort to set Guinness records for vow renewals and for trips down a water slide in a wedding dress.
Okay, that might not be for everyone, but if you're married, did you do something unique and distinctive as part of your ceremony or reception? Something a little different than the norm, or have you been to some kind of theme wedding that you thought was cool or just plain weird?
Let us know about unique twists in weddings, your own or others. Email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or leave us a message at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
I did a quick survey of Wisconsin Today hosts. Neither of us had any weird wedding stories to report, but maybe we're just boring people.
Maybe. Maybe. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Brad Kohlberg.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.